Good evening. This is Onaji Muid. This is Race Treaty, a radio program that highlights and seeks the remedy to the various and daily violations of international law as it relates to racism and human rights. We center our show on the International Convention to Eliminate Racial Discrimination, ICERD. We deconstruct white supremacy as a system, systematic, institutional, structural, economic, and political reality that adversely affects people of color worldwide on social, familiar, as well as community and personal levels. We seek to engage activists, social change agents, and other personalities who are working to dismantle racism. We conduct our interviews within the United Nations 10-year decade for people of African descent of 2015 to 2024 with the goals of recognition, justice, and development. We'll highlight news items and activities which are happening globally. The Race Treaty Program, in fact, is a program that comes to you on Black Talk Radio, digital radio station, and is an outreach of Anti-Racist TV, whose founder, Robert Benton, has coordinated. We also work with a collective, which we call ourselves the Race Treaty Collective, a variety of hosts that will bring to you various programs. Again, good evening. This is Onaje Muid, and welcome to Race Treaty tonight. Our program is on health equity and human rights. We feel that out of all the different health disparities, it begins with birth. You know, the indices of birth rates of the different groups, and Black people here in America, in the United States of America, and around the world, are certainly at the very bottom of that, save Indigenous people, history that many of our people come from as well. Our guest tonight is someone who I've known for quite some time, and the capacity in which we have known each other and worked has been one of brotherhood. I call him a brother from another mother. That's how close this person is to me. And it is certainly with a pleasure that I'd like to introduce to our listening audience, Tyrone Thaddeus Brown. My brother, good morning. Good evening.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Brother Anaji. I hope that I'm coming in clear. I'm calling in remotely. And, it's quite an honor, you know, to be asked to be a part of the program today. You know, Brother Naji is, you know, more than a brother to me. You know, I think of him not only as a brother, but almost as a, like an uncle. You know, as the old commercial used to say, you know, having an uncle in the business, you know, it is a positive thing. And Brother Anaji, or Uncle Anaji, you know, has been someone who has been a mentor, you know, a beacon of light, you know, someone who has been a great inspiration in my career, my growth and development in my journey in the helping profession of helping other human beings to help themselves. And then, you know, with the intent that with that new ability to help themselves, they go out and help others as well. So once again, thank you for having me on the show today, and, you know, blessings to all.
Thank you. Brother Tyrone, I know that your professional history of a committed is that of a committed and diversified service professional within the profit as well as not-for-profit, public, private, business, and health and human services, as well as education arenas in New York City, but not limited to a history that records you as the founder and principal servant of Isaiah Grace, independently owned and operated provider of business and health and human services. providing consulting, technical assistance, research, education, training, and support services. We also know that over these many years, Asaya Grace has supported and worked collaboratively with many organizations and individuals in Brownsville, East New York, particularly in the New York Child Welfare Neighborhood Network, and various other New York City-based health networks as well. In fact, we might look back and see that it's over 40 years that your experience has added to and contributed to mental and behavioral health topics and trainings and just an advancement, such as substance use disorders, mental disorders, co-occurring disorders, including families with multiple members experience chronic, severe, persistent co-occurring disorders, including trauma as well. So I see, I don't know, maybe at least 26 letters after your name. And I'm going to stop and ask you about these letters because you've earned them. And so often the things that we earn is minimized. And certainly for people who have been minimized in the United States of America, recognition is important. And this program uses the three principles of recognition and justice, as well as development, as our themes as we have discussions inside of ICER, the International Convention to Eliminate Racism. So I see PhD, I see MSOL, I see BS, HSM, I see CADT, I see CASAC, and I see ICADC. What do all those letters mean?
Well, Brother Naji and brothers and sisters on the program here, let me first say that the letters in themselves don't mean a great deal. What's important is understanding the context that they are in. And let me just do a little disclosure here. I've been on this here, this journey on this third rock from the sun that some folks call Mother Earth here for 50 plus years. And when we talk about 40 plus years of experience in areas of health and of mental health and behavioral health and criminal justice and just all of those types of situations pertaining to the human condition, that's based on my own development, my own personal experience growing up, even before there was the academic learning and understanding of what the behaviors were, I was experiencing them directly and indirectly. So my experience is both academic as well as experiential in the sense of, you know, from the layman's perspective. The letters in themselves, within there is the, you have to understand that I was a 17-year-old ninth-grade dropout, still in the ninth grade after 3 years because, you know, I was too involved in, you know, doing things that weren't congruent with going to class and getting that formal academic education, as you will. And so at a certain point, the school system kindly informed me that, you know, if I wasn't going to go to class, I could no longer attend their schools and play on their football teams and their chess teams and things of that nature, which, you know, was things that inspired me and motivated me. And so from the time of from 17 until 32, I did what I need to do on the street level, if you will, and behind a few gray walls, if you will. And at the age of 32, it dawned on me, that if I continued to live my life the way I was living it, it would be like walking up to the woman who raised me and all of the predecessors and spitting in their faces, because I would be throwing away the opportunities that they had struggled through so that I would have the opportunity to do something with my life. And so that was my epiphany moment, my aha moment. And from that point on at 32, I made the commitment that I was going to dedicate and commit the rest of my life, to doing the best that I could to honor those that came before me, and also to prepare the way and create opportunities as best I can for those walking the walk with me, and for those that would be coming behind us. So I got a general equivalency diploma at the age of 33. Clearly, I was not I was able to learn. It didn't take me long to get the GED, when I applied myself, and I just decided to stay in the process. And for the next 12 years, I just got that formal education, which began with the GED high school diploma, an associate's degree in human services, with a specialization in alcohol and substance abuse counseling, and then a bachelor's degree in health and human services, behavioral science, and management, sort of combination. And then I just went on and got a master's in business while I was at it. And then I figured I'd put it all together, connect the links and the bridges with a doctorate degree in health and human services administration. But let me say to you that none of those are more important than the letters DA.D, which I am really honored to have, and those letters form the word dad or daddy. As a father of four, there is nothing that gives me more honor to be blessed with the opportunity and the privilege to have four beautiful children of my own, which I know not only are mine, but they belong to the great creator and the universe. So that's a little something about what that alphabet soup means for me.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you for putting your life into context, and to say that, as we say in from South Africa, Ubuntu, I am because we are, therefore I am. And you just kind of very eloquently lay that out in terms of your life. And you really shared with us a scenario that is so prevalent and so pervasive of young men, particularly very young, bright young men, men of color, black boys, who are in environments that, in fact, doesn't recognize nor affirm them, and engage them in a fashion that they can be engaged, so therefore it becomes easy to, in fact, disassociate, and then find themselves out of that system, only to find themselves into another system that's already been constructed just for that purpose. We're talking about the school to the prison pipeline, and that you were able to get through that, and at the age of 32, say, wait a minute, let me give this some thought. Am I the one that's going to dishonor my mother and just give her back a life of disdain and disappointment? And at that point, you said no. And that's, I guess, the ultimate question that we face as humans. Who do we respect? Who do we honor? How do we then respect and honor those persons by the life that we create, which is the person we develop ourselves to be? And certainly that was a pivotal moment for you, and you made me reflect on some of mine as well. So thank you so very much for that. But I will also say that it was that turning point that you decided to, in fact, attend to your own ascendancy into the man that you are, into the human being that you are, into the warrior, the culture warrior that you are. But none having letters greater than D-A-D, dad, which is, reminds me of a quote from Malcolm X, is that anyone can be the father of a child, you know, but can you be a dad? And I'm paraphrasing where he's talking about, of course, the biological function versus the social function, and that which you have eloquently, again, shared with us. So you were invited to a program and participated in the Actualizing the United Nations Decade for People of African Descent, the Human Services Professions Organizing Challenge for Health Equity in Social Work, Psychology, and the Addiction Fields in New York City. We are reminded that it was Dr. Martin Luther King who said, of all forms of inequity, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and inhumane. He said this back in 1964 at the Civil Rights Mississippi Freedom Summer 1966 convention for the Medical Committee for Human Rights. So this theme, our show tonight is health equity and human rights. So my question to you is, how did your presentation contribute to that question? What is health? What is health equity? And how do we achieve it in these current conditions in which we are living?
Well, I think when we talk about health and health care and health equity as it pertains to those of us of African descent living in an oppressive and colonialized environment, you know, we have to understand that we are in someone else's house. We are on someone else's plantation, in the sense of we didn't ask to be here. You know, we were, for all intents and purposes, doing just fine, you know, in our own house, you know, hanging out in our own backyards and doing our own thing, you know, before we were so unkindly, you know, ushered on across the passage, the middle passage, for those of us ancestrally that actually made it all the way and didn't wind up at the bottom of the ocean. So we're over here, but we're in somebody else's house. And, you know, when you're in someone else's house, you have to understand that, you know, their rules apply, their rules and regulations apply, you know, and, you know, from day one, you know, we were never even considered, you know, those of us of African descent. And we're not even going to get on the topic right now of those that were already here before the colonials got here.
Well, I would like you to certainly share, because that's a big part of our history that a lot of it has been erased, purposely yeah. so. Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, Cherokee is also part of your cultural lineage.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the woman who raised me, you know, for all intents and purpose, was she was an indigenous of ancestry. You know, she was actually a Mohawk, you know, and Mohawk Nation, part of the Iroquois Nation, here in the Northeast. So, you know, I was raised with a lot of the blood and the spirit in me, you know, of Native American as well as African descent. And of course, quite naturally, for those of you who know me, you know, there's a little bit of the colonialist thrown in, too, because I don't know how all of that happened. Listen, if we're going to break this down, and, you know, I'm going to call it like it is, we're going to open up this Pandora's box, you know, let's go there, you know. We're talking about my history, you know, being conceived in the summer of 1962, you know, somewhere and somehow in Birmingham, Alabama, you know, by a biracial event, if you will. We don't know whether or not it was consensual or non-consensual or whatever the case may have been. What we do know from the story is that the woman, for whatever reason, came up north to give birth to this child. And then once the child was out of her womb, she just vanished into the sunset, if you will. And this child, you know, has never known his biological mother nor father, you know, and spent the first 7 years of his life as a ward of New York State. And somehow his mother, who raised him, somehow got custody of him at the age of 7 months old and raised him in her longhouse, you know, and gave him the last 21 years of her life, as she was already 60 when she brought this young man under her roof. And then when she passed away 21 years later, having always said to this young man that, "I only ask the God of my understanding to let me live long enough to see you turn 21 and be able to stand on your feet, your own feet." And then 2 weeks after this young man turned 21, he was blessing this woman and putting her to rest in sacred ground. So yes, so that blood runs strong in me. You know, so when we talk about being here in health equity and all of that, you know, the bottom line, as Martin Luther King says, you know, that is the most horrendous of all inequities. And so I think of it as, you know, as people of African descent and Native American descent and any oppressed people who don't fall under the umbrella of being those of privileged blood, as intended and as appropriated and as applied over the years by those in control of this system here. You know, I think of veal. If anyone knows what veal is and how veal is processed and made, you'll know that the object is to take the baby cow, you know, and put that baby cow in a tight, dark box, standing on its legs, and keep that cow in that situation for a period of time. And the object is to keep that baby calf on his legs, and so that it will be weak, but the meat will be tender and easy to eat. And here in America, when we talk about health equity and people who have been oppressed and who are part of the population of having unequal justice and unequal rights and unequal health, we're talking about that veal, you know, that has been kept weak over time. And the same goes with that. In this government, in this here, the history of this country, you know, alcohol and drugs, whether licit or illicit, has been the biggest, if you will, engine, economical engine in this country, going all the way back to the triangular slave trade, transcontinental slave trade. When we talk about people, you know, sugar and rum, you know, and that whole process and you know, all of that whole industry. And then we talk about prescription drugs and over-the-counter drugs. We're not even getting. We're just talking about the legalized drugs here. And then when you throw on the others, you know, this country has always been about creating situations where there's going to be greater opportunity for unhealthy outcomes than for healthy outcomes. So you have to understand, when you talk about health inequities, you have to keep the people unhealthy in a certain, to a certain extent, in order to generate the revenues, to create the economy. You don't make money by providing the cure. You make the money by keeping people sick. And you throw all of that into the context of oppression and how these unhealthy, these social determinants of health, as we call them today, these unhealthy scenarios and situations and opportunities to engage in unhealthy behaviors is really targeted towards those who have been historically underserved, oppressed, boxed in. And so these things have become the tools to try to escape, you know, from these social and individual psychological and spiritual pains. Langston Hughes says it in a nutshell. What happens, you know, to a people when a dream is deferred? Well, I don't know if there ever was a dream, you know. Some people would say it was a nightmare, still is a nightmare. You know, but what happens when you're not able to self-actuate as a fully self-expressed human being, man or woman? Well, over a period of time, you begin to devolve and eat upon yourself.
You gave such a historical point of view, and I can see how how the oppression has had to look at us in a way of like, okay, we have captured this black body, we have captured their mind. Now, how do I manipulate it in such a fashion to get from it what I need at the time my economic and political system demands a particular thing? So they need is healthy enough to work the fields, to grow their food, to suckle their children. They need is healthy enough so that we can perform that labor. And it's a fine line where you can't make them too healthy, and certainly not mentally or spiritually, because then they might rebel. So I have to keep them subjugated. And after you move from the agricultural system, then the question becomes, well, we don't really need you to work in the fields anymore. Okay, so now you fought and you fought your way, and now you became part of the industrial class in terms of workers working in Detroit with all of those, cars, you know. And let me not skip over the convict lease system. Let me not skip over the sharecropper system, right? How our labor was then at first on the plantation, the so-called master had to take care of all of our needs, right? And then when we move into the sharecropping system, well, no, you take care of your own needs, and at the end of the year, you owe me more money than you started out with. So at each epoch, there was this balance between how well do we want these people and how can we exploit them? And now when we get to the point where it says, you know, who needs the Negro, right? When we get to a point where we don't need you in the field because now we have replaced your work in on the agricultural arena with big carbines and machinery, then at this point, we can still use your body by making you sick and having you dependent upon the pharmaceutical industry, and we still can mine We still can exploit you. We can still get something out of this body. This sick body that now we can put in all these centers for kidney failure, for renal failure. We can set up all these businesses in your community so we can still extract some economic value from you as you get weaker and weaker and weaker. How you laid that out, it seems to be a whole, if not thesis, certainly a dissertation just on that alone. I know there are people who want to chime in on that. You mentioned something about this this human need for us to be fully actualized. And of course, the show is looking at the topic of health, equity, and human rights. It was El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, Malcolm X, who said that the common goal of 22 million Afro-Americans is respect as a human beings, the God-given right to be a human being. Our common goal is to obtain the human rights that America has been denying us. We can never get civil rights in America until our human rights are first restored. We will never be recognized as citizens there until we are first recognized as humans. Yeah, that was Malcolm X who laid that out for us. So,
Brother Nadi, forgive me for jumping in, but I think that, you know, that's critical because it's also been stated that no one is going to give us, you know, our human rights. No one can give us our human rights. We are human, and we have the right, you know, to actuate as human beings. So we have the right to declare ourselves. We don't need anyone else to declare us as human beings or to permit us to be human beings. You know, we have to declare ourselves human beings, you know, and the right to exist and actualize and as human beings. No one's going to give us that. We have to take that. We have to own that. We have to become that, be that. No one's going to give that to us. We have to become that, and that's an inside job, and you know, so we can talk about the system, and we understand the system was created and designed as an engine, a methodology to extract, you know, every ounce and every grain that it can from, you know, this economical fuel, if you will, that's called those who are not of the privileged group. So we have to declare our own human rights and say, no. I'm no longer a slave, you know. I'm no longer 3/5 of a man, you know. I am no longer, you know, and whatever stories we tell ourselves, we have to shift our dialogue within ourselves, and we have to rise up. You know, I am a man. You are a man. We are men. God created men. God created women. God did not create 3/5 of a man. You know, so when we stand up, and that's what we're about now. That's what we're doing now. You know, we're moving in the right direction. You know, it's been almost a half a century since some of our predecessors who had us close to bursting through the doors and the barriers were ceremoniously or unceremoniously beheaded. And we know that had a major impact in the trajectory of the movement coming out of the 50s and the 60s. But by the early 70s, the damage had been done. You know, the saboteurs and the assassins had struck, and it created such a wound.
For our listening audience, let me just kind of do some background. Brother Tyrone is giving reference to the COINTEL program, the counterintelligence program that was conceived by one of the biggest criminals on the planet, Edgar Hoover, who said that we must stop the rise of any black messiah, anything that can ignite the consciousness and our struggle for freedom has to be confronted, has to be identified, neutralized, either character assassination or actually physical assassination. And certainly Malcolm X was a victim of the COINTEL program, as was Geronimo Pratt, as was the brother out of Chicago, with the Black Panther Party. And the list goes on, and many who are still lingering in jails for crimes, one that they didn't commit other than just wanted to be a man. So the state of our people has to do directly with those who have chose to oppress us and keep us in these binds economically, physically, and psychologically. And because of this moral, this physical, as well as character assassination, this absence of leadership has certainly burdened us in so many ways. So I just wanted to kind of put that footnote in as you were speaking to that reality. So when we have to understand that, because then we put it in a total context. You also gave reference to, I kind of interrupted you. Let me see if you can continue your thought, but I certainly want you to complete that and then go on to say, what was your involvement in this event in New York City, actualizing the United Nations decade, and what would you want to happen from this point forward?
Brother Naji, thank you for tying up the loose ends there, if you will, because you're absolutely right. You know, it is necessary to put it in a historical, political, and context in terms of what has occurred and what continues to occur. Just to go a little bit further, you know, and even after the this year occurred. You know, and our young people of the time, back in the late 60s and the 70s, you know, in their outrage, you know, of what they perceived, what was and understood what was happening, made attempt to try to carry that torch on. But because of the lack of organization and leadership and unity within our people at that time for multiple reasons. Those attempts were decapitated as well, and those groups of young people, you know, they were turned against each other. And they have been at war, or we have been at war within ourselves. If I'm making any sense here, because of the nature, the cunning, the baffling, insidious nature, you know, of the oppressive system, you know, a civil war amongst ourselves has been generated over the past 40, close to 50 years. So, that's how insidious it is.
Yeah.
So, I know you want me to talk a little bit more about I'm doing.
Well, I do, but I want to also say for the audience, you're giving reference to how drugs were put into our community at the height of the civil rights movement to dope our people down, a form of chemical warfare, and how the dope got in there through the mafia that was working hand in hand with the CIA, with FBI, to ensure that that would happen, for the purpose of killing off that young spirit of the students who was in the forefront of our movements. And it succeeded. And then they went on to distribute drugs to certain, the Black Rangers in Chicago and different places. And then they started to create turf, right? With the turf came, then they added guns to the mix. So you have drugs, you have guns, you have violence, you have destabilization. And that occurred in every major city where you had any concentration of black people across the United States of America. And from that, you have this misguided, starting with the Crips and the Bloods, looking at the Black Panthers, but just lost their way and inherited, then took on a value system that was in fact antithetical to what the Black Panthers were doing. But that was the father. That was the father of those gangs, in fact, was the Black Panther Party. So now you have these gangs with turfs, with drugs, with guns to protect their turf, their business, their livelihood, that, as you said, starts to live off the people. And now we see this is proliferated throughout all of Black communities. So for you to bring all these, you know, scenarios and these frameworks, you know, up, and you're talking just as you've done, you have brought such clarity to the situation, and you use the word colonial. You know, we are a domestic colony. And until we understand that and then fully operate from that, we could never be free. It's like somebody like Harriet Tubman said that I would have freed more people if they only knew they were slaves, if they was enslaved. So you can't free a domestic colony if it doesn't understand itself as being one. And you've done that. So again, that's another footnote. You make you put in the footnotes to make sure, particularly our younger listening audience, will see what we're talking, why we're talking, why you're saying what you're saying, and how it is in fact historically proven, a proven fact that this in fact is the situation. So yes, please go on and tell us about the work that you're doing. We have maybe about another 10 minutes in our interview tonight, but of course I'm going to have you back because there's so much more stuff that you need to say and I need to footnote. I think we're doing a good, you know, coming down the court, you know, passing back and forth, the left side to the right side until we get to the hoop. So yes, Brother Tyrone, please continue.
Yes. Let's continue to tie those pieces together. You know, it's a jigsaw puzzle, and we need to be able to get to being able to show the full picture here. We must know ourselves, and we must understand the circumstance that we're in the process of overcoming. Well, for what I do, I do what it is that you know, I believe in my heart that I'm called to do. You know, I understand that, you know, but for the grace of God go I, you know, and you know, I'm in the situation I'm in today and able to do the things that I'm able to do today, not by any great power of myself, but, you know, by the power of the great architect, creator, known by many names, but only one true being. So, you know, it's like, you know, reach down into the abyss that I was hanging out in, you know, and pluck me out. And so many others, but others, you know, are still down in the abyss, and some never made it out, and some never will. But for some reason or another, I was plucked out. So I understand that, you know, my life is not just for me. You know, for me, it's all about the give back, and it's been all about the give back for the last two decades. You know, to the best of my ability, you know, I still stammer along and, you know, still stutter because the English language isn't my native language. And, you know, I'm, you know, just not that motivated to be all that proper. I'm just going to be me. I'm a man. I declared myself a man, you know, and I will not allow anyone to take that from me, to deny me of that, you know, and that is the message I bring.
What Malcolm said, I am a human being on this earth right here and right now, and I intend to bring into existence my human rights by any means necessary. I declare myself a human being, and that's what you had said earlier, and that's what you have repeated in your statement just there. So there's a show that I intend to do called Echoes of Malcolm X. And certainly you are certainly that echo and you are that voice today. It is such a wonderful thing to have you on the show to share with our listening audience who you are, to share with the audience the work that you've done and are doing. So where do you intend to, how do you intend to continue this work, particularly since we are in New York City, making this connection between health equity and human rights? Where do you see that movement going?
Well, you know, I'm in the trenches and have been for a minute, you know, ever since that epiphany moment, you know, and you know, just in everything I do, you know, right now I'm doing some work with the largest health and human services labor management organization union in the United States and possibly the world, 1199 SEIU. We have over 400,000 members, you know, and I'm overseeing the training and education components for the Institute for Continuing Education. And, you know, we are the education and training wing of the union for this nearly half a million members and 250,000, or I should say around about 60,000 here on the East Coast alone in the Northeast. And in designing these programs and things of this nature to assist these workers with being able to maintain, well, first of all, in acquiring their licensing and certifications for their various titles, professional titles, social workers, drug counselors, nurses, across the board, like 24 different professional technical titles. But the nature of the programs that I work rigorously and vigorously with my team on developing and delivering are not just programs on standard medical practice as it pertains to care for you know, various diseases, but also bringing flavor and color, you know, to those presentations, to those seminars, because I understand that our members and those that participate in our programs are a microcosm of the greater society. So what we try to do is we try to ensure that the programs not only address the medical issues, but also address the underlying historical and psychosocial issues that are the causality of chronic health conditions. Wow. Because we understand that you cannot, you know, treat the acute symptom, you know, and expect that the individual is not still at a high risk, you know, for the disease to continue to grow and to, again, you know, take control of their lives. So, you know, putting all of this in the context of ACA, Affordable Care Act, DSRIP, which is a healthcare model that has been implemented across the nation here in New York, you know, that is really aimed at reducing hospitalization stays, cutting costs, and you know, in improving long-term health, all in that context, and bringing forth interprofessional collaborative care practice across the continuum of care. But again, not just addressing the outer symptoms, you know, but addressing, you know, the core causalities of disease, social determinants of health. When we talk about population diversity and population health, you know, these are all terms that all of a sudden have come up over the past 10 years. But for those of us that go back, you know, this is the fight that we've been in, you know, for, you know, a long time, going all the way back. And you know this, Anaji, way back in the middle to late 90s when you and I, you know, began to see each other more often, you know, and some of the things that we were involved in back then, you know, in organizations and events and activities, you know, this is the fight that we've been in that has finally, in some ways, now seemed to have caught up to us.
So, okay, let's make it plain. We talk about NBAC, the National Black.
We talk about the National Black Alcoholism Addictions Council, you know, yeah. That's and, right. You know, the group that came out of Howard University of Concern, people of African descent that were just appalled at, you know, the fact that the whole alcohol and treatment industry, you know, was counter-designed to address the true needs and cultural sensibilities, you know, of people of color, and that we needed to do something that was going to allow our people the greatest opportunity to be able to address these issues that, as we described earlier in this program, you know, were killing us and are still killing us. You know, this is a war. We are at war, you know, and people have to understand, you know, that, you know, either we are going to come together in one understanding and one voice and one movement and move forward, or, well, you know, the other option is not so pretty. And so I'm just going to move on forward. I know you're going to move forward with me, Brother Najee, and countless others. We're going to move forward. We're not waiting for anybody to give us permission. You know, we're moving forward, and, you know, we need everyone.
That's
we
right.
need everyone able-bodied, able-minded. We need everyone to get on board and move forward with us.
Very good. So, Brother Tyrone, if someone wanted to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
Just call Tyrone.
You got to give them a number or email. I mean, you know, as Erica Badu said, you better call Tyrone and don't use my phone.
I can be reached at tyrone.brown@1199funds.org. Tyrone.brown. And for those of you who are not aware, you know, and I shared this the other night at the conference, you know, Tyrone Brown, that is like standard slave name, you know, Tyrone Brown. Tyrone is a county in Tyrone and Brown, they're both separate counties in Ireland. I believe Tyrone is in is a county in Northern Ireland, and Brown is a county in Southern Ireland. I could have that a little mixed up, but Brown is also such a common name. It's Irish, it's Scottish, it's English, it's German, it's all of that. Tyrone Brown, slave name 101. It's about 10,000 of us legally documented here in the United States. You know, slave name, there it is. But for those of you, you know, you can just call me T. You don't have to call me Tyrone. You can just call me T. You can call me T. Thaddeus. You can call me Thaddeus. You can call me anything you want. I love to eat, so please call me in time to get some of that good home cooking.
So that's tyrone@1199funds.org. Brother Tyrone, it's been a pleasure, and certainly anytime we get together, it warms my heart, it educates my mind, it inspires me, and all of it is the laughter and the brotherhood that keeps me alive, man. You keep me alive, and I just want to thank you. To our listening audience, you have been listening to Race Treaty. Our guest has been Tyrone Thaddeus Brown, a man of many dimensions and experiences and accomplishments. Really, Phoenix rising from the ashes and inspiring and being a leader in our struggle for human rights and health equity in so many different ways. And he will certainly, this will not be the last time he'll be on these radio waves. So this is Onajim Weed signing off with Race Treaty tonight. And we want to thank you for being with us. And we'll close out with our little drumming sign off.